Whether it's a wedding dress or old family photos, just remember three things.
There's kind of a divine trilogy in preservation called cool, dark, and dry. And Krista and I will say this over and over and over again.
That's Jennifer Hain-Tepper, the preservation librarian at U of I's library, joining us to talk about this weekend's Preservation Emporium at the Spurlock Museum. And we speak with two New York-based Palestinian artists. Their new Central Illinois exhibit is called And Yet My Mask is Powerful. Here's Ruwan Abu Rameh.
I think that in general, as artists, we're not only living in a time of crisis in Palestine or in the Middle East. It's a global condition in the sense that we're living in very, very difficult times that I feel are extremely violent.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. We'll get started after the latest news. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Think about what's in your basement or your attic. Is that where you tossed your dad's old baseball collection or your old baby quill? What about grandma's old black and white photos? Are they sitting in a shoebox covered in dust? We've all done it. For lack of time or a better place, we've put some of our most precious family treasures in places that might not be the best when it comes to safekeeping. But lucky for us, every year, the U of I Spurlock Museum and University Library put on their Preservation Emporium. They've got experts in various subjects, from textiles to books to musical instruments, digital media, even archaeology, who can tell you all about the preservation, treatment, and storage of your heirlooms and artifacts. It's tomorrow at the museum, and it's open to the public. We'll tweet out the information and have it up at our website for those of you in the Urbana area. Right now, two of those specialists are with me in our studios in Urbana. Krista D.C. Quinn is the collections manager at the Spurlock Museum, and Jennifer Hain-Tepper is the preservation librarian at the University Library. Both of you, welcome to the 21st.
Hello.
Thanks.
Krista, the Preservation Emporium has been going on for about a decade. How does this work?
Well, it's been really exciting. When Jennifer and I started this in, 2007, Jennifer?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we didn't know how many people would show up, but we have had over 130 show up to one of our events, and it's really exciting to have people come in, bring their family treasures. We get to have a lot of storytelling, talk about pieces that people want to take care of. It's been a really fun event for both the participants and those experts who come and advise.
Jennifer, have there been any unique items that people have brought in?
Well, they're always unique items. That's kind of the beauty of the event, is that every year different things come. I mean, there are some standard family Bibles and whatnot and quilts that we see every year. But there have been some really fascinating pieces that have come in. I think my personal favorite is one that Krista and I actually co-collaborated on, which was an artillery box from the Civil War that originally went over to Krista because Krista typically advises on textiles but is also kind of our de facto objects specialist, being a collections manager at the museum. But because it was bound in leather or wrapped in leather and leather books are my specialty, we kind of co-collaborated on that one. But the fact that of all the things that were kept, it was an artillery box.
Yeah.
It was just kind of strange, but it was in excellent condition. It was just fascinating to hear the story of how it got passed down and whatnot. And I think that was one of the most unique things that we've seen.
Oh, yeah. It was absolutely amazing.
So, Jennifer, you mentioned your area of expertise. That's books and paper. Is that correct?
That is correct. And photographs.
And so when it comes to books, papers, photographs, what do you think the most common mistake is that most people are making when they're in terms of preservation?
Storage. I think that's going to be universal for almost all of us, except maybe the archaeology people, because stone is really easy.
Well, that and also it's in the ground, then it's not.
Right. But for paper materials in particular, one of the biggest concerns is storage temperature and relative humidity and light exposure. And of course, a lot of these heirlooms, as you noted in the introduction, get squirreled away in the basement or the attic where the environment is terrible. And unfortunately, that really speeds up deterioration, particularly with photographs. But there are lots of other issues with pests and whatnot in storage as well. So it's finding a good storage environment for your materials. That's really the most important part and the most common mistake.
And what is a good storage environment? Does climate matter? I'm thinking about maybe how cold it might get or how hot it might get in an attic. Does that make a difference?
There's kind of a divine trilogy in preservation called cool, dark, and dry. And Krista and I will say this over and over and over again, is that you want to keep things cool. You definitely want to keep them in the dark, and you want to keep them from getting too humid because you want to avoid the risk of mold or insects or anything like that.
Generally, where you stay in your house is where you want to preserve your items. So you generally don't live in an attic unless it's finished, or in your basement unless it's finished and has a good temperature and relative humidity. So generally the main living floors are usually where that's the best preservation as well.
Right. So we recommend that people look at interior closets are usually the most stable place that is a good kind of out-of-the-way storage area, but also a good environment for family heirlooms.
And we also advise on how to display items in your home if you want to do that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Well, before we get to that, Krista, can you tell us about your area of specialization?
Well, I deal with objects. So our museum has all sorts of things from going back about 250,000 years, which I don't think most families will have, all the way up until modern age. But in this particular area, I mainly talk about textiles, so quilts, christening gowns. I've had samplers come in.
When it comes to old textiles, so I'm thinking particular of things like a family quilt, what are we doing wrong, or what are the most common mistakes you see?
People like to throw everything in the washer. That's usually the most common mistake. If something is coming apart, they want to wash it. And usually your washer can ruin things pretty quickly, especially if you have silks and some other things. And detergents can be pretty harsh on things.
And so should things be hand washed? Should you take them to professional dry cleaners? Should you not wash it?
Pretty much we're cringing. It's you can't see.
You can't touch it.
Yeah, you don't. You want to maybe bring it to a conservator in that case. It depends on the type of materials it's out of. Sometimes these things come out of homes that have been a lot of smoking. So you just want to be really careful in looking at that. And so sometimes, especially with crazy quilts, they're built of many different types of material. So sometimes the material actually affects each other. So, I ask, can you hang it over on one of those quilt display racks? Can you put it in a guest room that's not really stepped on by pets and that kind of thing? And, so it's mainly looking at that type of thing.
So if it somehow gets stained, you just kind of have to make your peace with it.
Well, yeah, I say the stains are part of the story in that case. So, unless you're actively using it, a lot of times that is part of its story.
Oh, okay, because sometimes maybe people see there's an old stain, you don't even know where it comes from, and you're trying to clean it because you think it's icy.
And so a lot of people just want things clean, and I don't blame them for that. So we talk about vacuuming things, I can explain that, but as soon as you add water or detergent to anything,
What people don't realize, and that Krista and I deal with on a fairly regular basis, is the fact that, of course, we all as humans live with water. It's part of life. Mm-hmm. But chemically, water is really reactive. And the action of washing is actually a very, very aggressive process. And so for most of the materials that we deal with in cultural heritage, introduction of water is actually a very scary and potentially dangerous thing. So while washing, your blue jeans seems perfectly okay, washing a fragile old quilt or an old silk flapper dress with a bunch of glass beads or something like that can actually cause more damage than it causes good.
Krista, I'm thinking about, go ahead.
No, I was just saying that, it's also, dry cleaning as well. You have to be really careful.
Krista, I wanted to ask you from the cleaning standpoint, maybe with quilts, one thing is maybe it might not be dirty, but it might get really dusty. Did you say something about vacuuming?
Yeah, you can totally vacuum them. So, you basically will take a, brush and, you kind of lightly vacuum if it's not going to, get sucked up into it. I will have a demonstration vacuum there. And so you can kind of carefully vacuum it if there's not a lot of loose pieces. But if we're talking about the flapper dress with all the beads, you don't want to add a vacuum to it. So instead we brush it off. So we have brushes, and we'll have some of those there at the Emporium.
And one handy little trick that we use when we vacuum books, because we vacuum books too, but that works with textiles, is if you're not certain how fragile it is, you can actually put a piece of pantyhose over the top of the vacuum so that if, God forbid, anything does get sucked up, it gets trapped by the little screen there and doesn't get sucked into the
vacuum.
There
is nothing worse than having to fish through the vacuum for the thing that got sucked into the vacuum. Yeah. You learn that very fast in our field.
Krista D.C. Quinn is the collections manager at the Spurlock Museum. Jennifer Hain Tepper is the preservation librarian at the University Library. We're talking to them ahead of their preservation emporium. If you're in the Central Illinois area, we'll tweet out details for that. I wanted to ask, and either of you jump in here, about going back to the idea of quilts or tapestry. I think there's a kind of always two camps of people who think you have something beautiful, you should just use it or you should display it. What are your thoughts about someone who wants to be able to look at maybe a tapestry or a quilt rather than store it safely?
Well, I think that and this goes for books or photographs as well. You want to make sure that if you're going to put them in your home, not in direct sunlight, not in a kitchen because of the grease, that can lodge onto it, not near an open vent, and not near a fireplace. So you can display things with those parameters and it'll last longer. Now, you can always put it. It's the person who belongs to it. It's their item. So.
Right. I mean, that's generally what I recommend to people is you have to, if you, the reason you're keeping this is because you appreciate it. And if you want to see it, that is part of the reason that you're keeping it. There are ways to be strategic and smart about display to make sure that you're not intentionally damaging the object. But use and exposure will increase the deterioration as opposed to putting it in dark storage in a closet. But then what's the point?
Right.
I mean, I have family china that, you know, periodically I break. And I'm like, well, you know, but it's being used and it's being appreciated. And that's the point of having it, is enjoying it. So we can recommend safe ways to display. Interior walls is another one, as opposed to exterior walls, because there's less temperature and humidity variation. But generally what Krista was saying is it goes for almost any family heirloom, is just be sensible about how you're displaying it, and that will really help.
And also recording the story of it. So quite frequently, mm-hmm. if we recommend people frame it, that you actually tape on the back of it like an envelope, or you have something with the family story, because we hear these amazing stories.
Right.
And often that's not always translated down to the different generations, and that information is so valuable. That story is part, also needs to be preserved.
Right.
How do you suggest that story gets preserved?
Well, I usually do it iLegible, meaning on, like, if you're framing
on
something
paper.
On paper on the back.
Mm-hmm.
And so that way it travels with the piece all the time. I mean, you can also, you know, have it digitally, but, you know, this way when you inherit, like, your, you know, picture on the back, you're like, you see this envelope and then you pull it open and then you see these old letters, or you see whatever is corresponds with that story.
My grandfather, who was anal retentive and a photographer, actually went through and wrote little notes on every family heirloom and either put them with a piece of string or stapled them up under the furniture or whatever.
That's
and it's
awesome.
It's been invaluable to have the history of. We have a table that goes back to the pre-Revolutionary War period, and he has the whole lineage of how the table passed through the family. And if he hadn't written that down, I wouldn't know it.
And now you're preserving that information, because the information or the family story is just as important as the object itself.
Absolutely.
Chris, it's something I've always worried about, wondered about, is wedding dresses.
Right.
I actually just got back from a wedding, and people spend a lot of money storing dresses for future generations. Do you have to spend a lot of money on this? And what happens to them years later? Because I just feel like you don't necessarily see lots of brides wearing old dresses.
I know, right? And so I think that you do need to spend money on cleaning the dress. You know, because if you want someone to wear it again, you go to a reputable dry cleaner or, you know, a type of cleaner to do that. Unless it's an antique gown, then you do something different. But generally, they'll have boxes and things like that you put it in. Again, the same thing. Jennifer, you want to say it. Cool,
dark, and dry.
Yep. And you don't want to store it in your attic or your basement, interior closet, and box it away. Also, have a story of when this gown was used.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe a picture, like an actual picture of the wedding of the bride in the gown. And so that's also part of its story as well.
Yeah, so I like the idea of you all wanting, obviously it makes a lot of sense to record the story along with it. I want to ask you about wedding dresses, but one more thing that I think people like to collect, which is stamps. Jennifer, if you are an amateur stamp lover, or maybe you want to start doing this, if you see something, a cool one that maybe comes through the mail, what's the next best step?
Well, I got to say, I'm one of the people who is much maligned by the move to pressure-sensitive stamps, because that's made my life a whole lot harder. Back in the day when we had stamps that you actually had to lick, those were a whole lot easier to preserve, because unfortunately the adhesive that they use for pressure-sensitive stamps is much less chemically stable. And
so like self-stick stamps is
self-stick,
what you're
saying. Right,
like the
sticker stamps
okay.
that are what you get nowadays, unless you specifically seek out licky-sticky stamps.
Well, they tasted awful, the licky-stickies. I know, but all right.
Anyway. Nonetheless, the adhesive was a lot more stable on the licky stamps than it is on the self-stick stamps. So regardless, with modern stamps, assuming that most of them now unfortunately are pressure sensitive, in most cases what you want to do is try to cut it off the envelope. Don't try to steam it off. Don't try to lift it off. It's going to cause a lot of damage to the stamp. So, you know, ideally, a lot of people actually like to keep the postmark, keep the entire envelope. That's a whole lot easier than trying to remove the stamps and put them into some sort of book where it's just the stamp. So that's one key thing. And then honestly, they're just, again, they're paper storage. So getting a good quality album or folder or something to store them in to make sure that they're in a good storage environment. So putting them into like plastic sleeves, generally speaking, isn't great, but good quality paper storage is really advantageous, especially if you don't know.
And we're giving some of those away.
And we have a raffle and we're giving away good quality storage materials in our raffle.
Last question. We have less than a minute left, but I wanted to ask you quickly, what about someone who thinks they have something that's valuable? What should they do, especially as they're thinking about our audience that's listening throughout the state and may not be able to come tomorrow to the Preservation Emporium? What would you suggest?
They are welcome to give us a call. We will have, you know, on the website all the, you know, different departments. So I do, we do answer calls at times over the phone and that kind of thing.
Right. But in our jobs at the university, we can't provide any sort of appraisal purposes or anything like that. So we can direct them to the American Association of Appraisers, who are trained to be able to do this. We can look at things and say, wow, that looks really interesting.
Yes.
But we can't say whether it's valuable or not.
Yeah, I thought value as in preservation, because that's always how I think about it, right?
Now, I was thinking Antiques Roadshow.
No, yeah, we don't do that.
We don't do that.
Okay. Well, that is not happening tomorrow, but there's going to be a lot more advice. At the Preservation Emporium. It's at, if you're in Central Illinois, it's at the Spurlock Museum in Urbana from 1 to 4. It's free and is open to the public. I want to thank Spurlock Collections Manager Krista D.C. Quinn and University Preservation Librarian Jennifer Hain Tepper for being with us here on the 21st. Thanks for being with me, ladies.
Thanks so much for having us.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Krannert Art Museum is hosting an exhibit called And Yet My Mask is Powerful. It's a work from two New York-based Palestinian artists, Basil Abbas and Rouhan Abu Rameh. It's a complete audiovisual experience that debuted in London in 2016. We had a chance to visit the exhibit earlier, and we brought back a little audio postcard for all of you listening.
I'm Amy Powell. I'm curator of modern and contemporary art at Krannert Art Museum, and this is my exhibition with Basil Abbas and Rouhan Abu Rameh. It's a complete body of work from 2016 called And Yet My Mask is Powerful. The title comes from a poem by the feminist American poet Audrianne Rich from 1972. The artists are facing a moment of extreme violence in Palestine and in the Middle East. And they're struggling with how to make work in the wake of so much violence without reproducing a sense of endless crisis. Every time we think about Palestine, other places in the Middle East, it's often a sense of despair. And so the text of the poem appears throughout the installation alongside several of the images. Another big thread that we should talk about are these masks. So if the vegetation is really laid out on the palette behind us, there's a palette here in this gallery that explores an exhibition that the Israel Museum hosted of Palestinian masks, Neolithic masks. So there's a line, the line in the poem, in Audrianne Rich's poem, led the artists to Google masks in Palestine. And they found that there were these 9,000-year-old masks, probably the earliest masks that have ever been made. And as These masks are owned by the Israel Museum, and they're owned by a prominent collector in New York. Part of the Israel Museum's exhibition of these masks was an interactive website where viewers could manipulate the masks, turn them around, look at them, consider them. And so the artists hacked the data of the masks from the website and had them 3D printed. So we're seeing plastic 3D printed versions of 9,000-year-old Neolithic limestone masks in the space. They'll see five projected images in a room that's very green. And so it really immerses you into this sense of nature. A lot of the video itself shows some of the natural materials that we see in the gallery in part two. And we follow these young people as they're seeking out these villages, going into a cave, looking through windows that once stood, or openings in buildings. And then they find these masks and sort of turn around with them on. So the masks allow play on anonymity and identity. And yes, text from the poem, from Audrian Rich's poem, in English and in Arabic, appears large in all caps on the screen as well.
Thanks to producer Alan Montesilio for producing that audio of the Cranern Art Museum exhibit in Urbana. It's on display until July 14th if you're in the Urbana area. Curator Amy Powell is in our Urbana studios now, along with the two New York-based Palestinian artists behind this exhibit, Rouhan Abu Rameh and Basil Abbas. All of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Noah.
I wanted to start by asking you, one of the things that I think is was striking to me about this exhibit, first of all, is just the role that art can play in preserving or highlighting culture. And I wonder how you see this as being particularly challenging when it comes to Palestinian culture. Rouhan?
That's an important question, because actually, in a way, Palestinian culture is always under the threat of erasure. So there is this constant struggle, really, in terms of just being visible and just being present. And then in a very sort of tangible sense, when we're thinking about things like the masks, these Neolithic masks, they were mostly looted from the West Bank. And so you have a lot of kind of physical lootings happening of the material culture of the place, and they've been happening now for 60 years or more. And so it is a very important site of contestation. And the question is, then, as an artist, how can you intervene and try to, in a way, reclaim some of these things? But also, for us with the masks, it was very much about how to sort of activate the masks as a tool that can be used. So not just something that goes on display. So really thinking about culture as something that is living, and that is something that we're constantly writing and producing and creating.
Basil?
I would add to that that the masks also were, it wasn't just about breaking the aura of the mask, but also when the exhibition at the Israel Museum in Jerusalem first happened, there was a lot of media attention on these masks because they were the oldest known masks in history that have been discovered, that are known yet. And so there was all this mythology being produced around these masks about the state of Israel, or about somehow they belonged to the narrative of the state. And so part of what we try to do is produce this counter mythology or counter narrative to the masks. And so in the video, the mask, young Palestinians are making returns to destroyed villages inside Israel, but they're also wearing the masks. And in the text of the work, we sort of say that the young people are hacking these masks, from young Palestinians from the West Bank are hacking these masks, and they're taking trips to destroyed villages and producing these new rituals. So every time we show the work, this sort of story sort of comes out more and more in Google searches, and it's circulated. And so this counter mythology is produced. And that was kind of our way of trying to sort of counter that through our practice and our work.
And I do want to come back to the whole idea of museums and what's exhibited and who takes what. But I want to just ask you Basil, about what you were just talking about with the young people. So when you walk into the exhibit, there's videos, images that are projected onto the walls that are, as you were saying, showing young Palestinians walking through villages that have been destroyed. Why? Can I ask you, first of all, is this a thing? Do young people go to these places? Or are they sort of ruins? And I wonder if either of you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, basically, there is a movement that exists of young Palestinians that take these trips. And how we found out about them was actually through other activists who are friends, but also through the writings of young Palestinian academics who have been writing about this phenomenon. Because what was particular about these trips was that these were not nostalgic trips. These were trips that were taken to activate these spaces. So these spaces were being used as hold summer camps there, singing and dancing. They even, some villages, they renovated the churches and the mosques. And so they go and have Sunday mass there. They have their weddings there. So while seemingly our practice seems fictional or semi-fictional, it's actually a projection. So it's actually taking something that exists and is amplifying. In this sense, this is a movement that already exists, and we sort of are amplifying it and projecting it and opening it up to more possibilities through our practice.
We actually have a little bit of that video. Let's take a listen. Rowan, can you tell us more about these places? What were they, and what are people doing? What is the condition of them now? You can see some of them in the video. Mm-hmm. It looks like you are going through ruins. There's a lot of overgrown grass, and people are sort of walking through. Sometimes it looks like rubble.
Basically, these are Palestinian villages and towns that were either completely destroyed or partially destroyed in 1948 by Israeli forces during the establishment of the State of Israel. And we're talking about what is officially documented as 420 towns and villages. So you're talking about a lot of sites. And a lot of the Palestinians that left these villages and towns, they either were displaced internally, so they're actually now still living in what is now Israel, or they were displaced to Lebanon, Syria, and other parts of the world and became refugees there. And so the Israelis have a very strange relationship to these sites. A lot of them have been totally eradicated, but some of them are very old. So, you know, you go to a village and it dates back thousands of years, so it also has a sort of historical significance, so they kind of needed to preserve some of these places. So there's this very strange relationship between sites that have been totally destroyed, and actually the Israeli government then circulated these images in Arab papers so that the refugees would see their villages totally destroyed, and then some of them have been maintained and included in like national reserve parks. So there is this sort of strange thing that happens there. And very often it's actually quite difficult to find some of the places. So a lot of what we were sort of documenting were the actual trips that we made back, us trying to find the place, and just the experience of being in these places. It actually is a very powerful experience, because there is a sort of energy in these places. You feel that it's almost possessed in a way. So it's a very powerful, very visceral experience. And for us, we wanted to really capture that.
I'm speaking with a New York-based Palestinian artist. That's Rouan Abu Rameh. Basil Abbas is also in our Urbana studios, along with curator Amy Powell. Their exhibit is at the Cranard Art Museum now. Amy, as you're listening to Basil and Rouan talk about this, I think a lot of this is a question of culture and story and who defines that. And I wonder what was the motivation behind Krannert Art Museum. What was sort of the idea of why you all wanted to bring this exhibit to Central Illinois?
We wanted to bring this body of work here to the University of Illinois for a number of reasons, building, I think, substantially on what we've been talking about just now, about thinking about cultural artifacts as living and as things that have not already been decided. And oftentimes museums are a storehouse for culture that is seen as in the past or closed or inaccessible. Objects under vitrines. This is taken up, I think, rather famously now in the new Black Panther movie, for instance, where the anti-hero goes to the museum to recover an object from Wakanda. And so these are questions that are still very live.
To a British museum, we should point out, which is also not surprising. Right?
Yes, exactly. There are very well-known instances of objects in every museum. I don't think any museum is excluded from these conversations. And so to have Basil and Ruwan's work take up those questions, but also specifically for our campus, questions of Palestine are fraught everywhere, but especially here at the University of Illinois over the last 3 years or so, and probably longer than that, when we think about issues of indigeneity more broadly, especially in a state with the history of relationships with Native American communities. So all of that was very much on our mind when I learned about this work, and yet My Mask is powerful, and worked with faculty members in various departments of the campus to address how we would teach, how they would teach with this exhibition as well.
Amy, do you think there's a particular role university museums should play in curating this? I'm wondering if it's a different role than, for example, major museums in the cities, whether we're thinking about the Field Museum in Chicago or the British Museum in London that have these artifacts that don't belong to them. What role do you think university museums should play in this conversation?
Universities are factories for the production of knowledge. I mean, if we think about them that way, and where the work of thinking and of research is central to the mission of a university. And so university art museums are located sort of firmly within that mission. And so I do think that university art museums are in a privileged position to ask these kinds of questions and also to be more experimental. Larger municipal museums are maybe subject to certain kinds of influential voices, and certainly we are as well, but I'm thinking about boards of directors, certain kinds of collectors. University museums, because we are responding to students and to faculty and to major issues in the world, always with notions of free speech in mind and public speech, I think it's the place of a university museum to do more responsive and experimental work.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. The exhibit is called And Yet My Mask is Powerful. Amy Powell, who's the curator behind this work, along with the artists Basil Abbas and Ruwan Abu Rame, are with me in studio. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
First is supported by the University of Illinois Press, hosting the Association of University Press's annual Book, Jacket, and Journal Show in the Link Gallery at the School of Art and Design, April 2nd through the 13th. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Thank you. for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boudou. My guests are two New York-based Palestinian artists, Basil Abbas and Rouhan Abu Rameh. They're a body of work, and Yet My Mask Is Powerful is on exhibit right now at the Krannert Art Museum in Urbana. Curator Amy Powell is also in studio with us in Urbana talking about the exhibit about Palestinian culture and art. I want to get into some of the specifics of the exhibit. Basil, we've been talking about these masks, and I think one of the things visitors will notice when they walk into the exhibit is you have sort of the process of they have these Neolithic masks that you've been talking about, and you had them 3D printed, and they're currently on display at the exhibition. Can you tell us how you got a hold of those?
Yeah, I mean, basically, the whole project started with Adrian Rich's poem, Diving Into the Wreck, and we were basically isolating stanzas of that poem and seeing how it relates to us, how it relates to the moment, how it relates to our communities, etc. And one of the lines was, "And yet my mask is powerful. It pumps my blood with power." We were always interested in previous works of being anonymous or anonymity as a political act. And so for us, the masks or a mask, you know, is you're able to be to take up other positions or to be other to be someone else or to hide your identity with a mask. And of course, when you think Palestine in masks, you immediately think of the black ski mask. And so what we did was actually simply put in a Google image search of Palestine masks. And as expected, most of the images were of people in ski masks. But then there was this one image of this really old-looking masks. So I clicked on it, and that took us to the Israel Museum and the Israel Museum's website. And then that's when actually we discovered the masks. And of course, it became a very central aspect in the work. With all our works, we basically have a long research-based practice, but we really allow things to come into the work as we research. And so it started with a stanza of the poem and then a Google image search. And then basically that's how we ended up with the mask.
And so that's what you'll see when you walk in, is you'll see in the exhibit there are these boards on top of the display images that you were just talking about as you see them on a computer desktop. Rouhan, why did you want to show that in addition to the images?
Essentially, the project is using Palestine, so the destroyed villages and the returns to the villages and the masks, as an avatar to think about what's happening in the whole region. It's really thinking through how entire sort of living fabrics and communities are erased and the ways in which we can deal with these moments of really extreme violence and erasure that's being enacted on every single aspect of life there. So, and it's also about how we can sort of then resist this erasure. So I feel that all that what you're seeing in terms of the images and the searches and the process is really unfolding the different sort of questions and aspects of the project. So it's like really opening it up into other spaces and other fields. And part of the reason that it formally sort of is articulated as something that is ongoing is largely because there is always this sense of the incomplete or the partial in our works. That for us is very much because we ourselves feel that we're part of an incomplete project in Palestine. But it's also connected very much to ideas of how our states of being in Palestine are sort of incomplete. Our lines of visibility are incomplete and partial. So that's part of the reason why it takes on this sort of form. And then in a way, people in this space, as they're going through the exhibition, are also then creating and activating their own scripts and deciphering and putting things together. So there's a certain degree of almost engagement that the work demands of you. Not that you have to give it, but it sort of does ask it.
Well, and also, I guess, of wanting to bring people into that incomplete state of being. Yeah. Basil, is that something you feel like? That's something also I was thinking as Rouhan was saying this. Is that something that you have felt personally in your life, being a Palestinian artist who's based in New York?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not just me, but it's actually a sort of like a thing in Palestine. We were reading recently we were rereading Edward Said, After the Last Sky, and he talks about how when Westerners look at Palestinian literature or art, they're looking at the content most of the time, but people don't pay attention to the form, this sort of fragmented, incomplete form that is in literature and in art across the board when you talk about Palestinian culture. And that has a lot to do with this sort of what Rowan was talking about, which is this incomplete project or something that is not yet finished. And that comes out in like stutters and glitches and micro samples. And that sort of is, you know, that comes out in our work, definitely, this sort of incomplete and the fragment. And that's actually our experience living there, but also even visually, you know, your lines of vision are constantly blocked, whether it's by a wall or a checkpoint. So things are always fragmented because of, you know, the colonial situation that we're in.
And Rowan, do you feel like a Western audience, and particularly an American audience, has at all a clear picture of that? I'm just thinking of what Basil was saying about even when you're Googling masks, what comes up is black ski masks and people mm-hmm. thinking of terrorists or bombings or things like that, as opposed to the culture and this oldest mask in the world.
I think obviously Palestine is a place that's heavily mediated, heavily represented and misrepresented, and people have very sort of two-dimensional images of the place. I feel like our practice is very much starting from this idea that why don't we try to read the world from Palestine rather than the other way around. So really, refusing to just think about Palestine or allow the issue of Palestine to be ghettoized as a singular issue. So really kind of opening up that experience to a multitude of experiences. And when people are coming into the show, it's not like they're going to get a very clear sort of tangible few lines about what's happening there. I don't think that's the intention. But it's just about activating different grounds, or almost like shifting the ground a bit in the way people are thinking or seeing certain issues, certain narratives and certain stories. And it's sometimes even just like introducing a different set of sentences or images in relation to that experience. So it's really about these very small interventions that we do that actually destabilize. So I think a lot of our work is sort of destabilizing certain conceptions. And then it's sort of interesting the extent to which people relate their own lived experience to the work. So we get a lot of different readings of our work, and some of them are not even connected to Palestine. That's what we're trying to achieve, is to open the work up and allow it to kind of circulate in different ways.
I'm speaking with artist Rowan Abu-Rame and Basil Abbas about their work, which is being exhibited right now at the Cranern Art Museum. And Basil, to Rowan's point about how people react to it, I imagine you also hear from people, just anyone who's been displaced, how much this story really resonates with them.
Absolutely. I mean, like Rowan was saying, we're trying to open up the work, and we've had multiple readings because that has a lot to do with this unfolding of the process as well. So the body and the viewer in the space is able to sort of navigate on their own and sort of make their own readings. And we've had, from this particular work, we showed it in Germany, and someone was really reading into gentrification, for example, even though that was not our intention, but that was there. And of course it relates to that because of, you know, colonizing aspect of, you know, gentrification, obviously. And then other readings included like the whole idea of the virtual and the digital and the physical and the manifestation of the movement of material from physical to digital back to the physical, etc. And so there have been multiple readings.
Yeah, so I wanted to just ask you about, just to end by asking you about the whole idea of making art in a time of crisis. And just to ask all of you again about what you've said about what are sort of, particularly American, but worldviews are of Palestinians, of Palestine, and this whole sense of despair that's often associated with it. And I wonder for you all, if you feel like it's hard to, how much you think about the current situation and unrest and all of that? And if you're able to separate, is it possible to sort of not have that be front and center? It's certainly not the case in this work, right? I think there's just sort of that's around the edges of it. But I wonder how much you think about the current state of unrest and how you balance that with what you're trying to do in terms of preserving and representing a different picture of culture.
I think that in general, as artists, we're not only living in a time of crisis in Palestine or in the Middle East, it's a global condition in the sense that we're living in very, very difficult times that I feel are extremely violent on many different levels. And that violence can also be slow forms of violence in terms of precarious working conditions. So there is this feeling of, I think, general disillusionment and despair with the way things are, and a very strong impulse that people want to live and inhabit the world in a different way. And part of the issue is that I find that the kind of imaginary of power is constantly one of crisis and the certain impossibility of any real actual change to the world. I mean, we're living in a moment that is also a huge ecological crisis. So the question is that really, as an artist, what is the position of the artist in times like this, and what can artists do? And that's a very difficult question, and I think it's a question that we're constantly asking ourselves and engaging with. I don't feel like there are a set of answers, but I feel like the fact that the question remains and you keep asking that question in terms of what am I trying to do with my practice, how does my practice extend out just from the exhibition space to actually be able to have some sort of affect, that's a very important question to continue to ask. And in a way, I feel like with our work, we're really very much trying to work on the level of imaginary, because we feel that so much of what is actually being occupied and sort of colonized is our imaginary and our ability to imagine other ways of being and inhabiting the world. So how can we keep that space alive and not just survive this moment, but actually still be generating a different imaginary in a very, very difficult time?
I think the question of why are we doing what we're doing and who cares about, who cares? Like, that's an important question that we ask ourselves, at least before starting a project or before thinking about a project. Like, why does this matter right now? And to who does it matter? And it's very easy to, as an artist, while you're working, to sort of forget to ask that question, because, you can easily become self-engrossed in your own sort of practice and in your own world and your own art world. And so these are the questions that, for me at least, allow me to sort of think about how my practice is relevant to the world, not just to me and to the art world.
The exhibition is called And Yet My Mask is Powerful. I want to thank Basil Abbas and Ruwan Abu Rameh, as well as Cranford Art Museum curator Amy Powell, for being with me to talk about this. Thank you all. I appreciate you coming by. That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us. If you want to send us an email, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to figure out all of our social media handles, you can just remember our website. That's 21stshow.org. Speaking of social media, if you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. If you search for us on Facebook, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on. You can see the things we're reading. You can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. I want to thank all the folks who work on The 21st, Jason Croft, Steve Mork, Scott Cameron, Robin Lynn, Alan Montesilio, Libby Foster, and our interns, Fatima Farha. Thanks to the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.